of that innovation. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Fred Miller and his team to take us through this presentation and discussion.
Thank you very much. I think that given the number of people we have here and who they are, it's probably worthwhile introducing ourselves around, and then I'll tell you what we're going to be doing. You have some paper, or had some paper. Do you want some more, or do you? Okay. Do you want to make sure they've got that package?
Charlie Hales, Mayor.
Dan Saltzman, City Commissioner.
Nick Fish.
John Russell, a member of the committee.
Oxygen Facility Services.
Brian Tange, Internal Business Services.
Ken Rust, Bureau of Revenue and Financial Services.
Ink Sheldon, member of the committee.
Daniel Truman, City Budget Office.
Andrew Scott, City Budget Office.
Sarah Lowe, City Budget Office.
Tom Walsh, Observer.
And member of the committee.
Mike Cohen.
Rachel Wiggins, Mayor's Office.
I'm David Chaff, Water Bureau.
I'm Chris Moorman, Commissioner Mayor's Office.
Shipley, Mayor's Office.
Okay, I hope that made everyone comfortable. No one moving, so that's fine. I'll start in. Today is a briefing on the Portland building, and I think I've had conversations with all of the commissioners individually, but it seemed time to bring it together. It's a major project to bring it together and make sure you know where we are and where we're headed. It's not a heavy decision meeting, but I think it will be worthwhile to get you updated. I tend to be chronological, so let me start, and I'm going to go through at 20,000 feet, if not 30, and talk about overall the project and where we're headed. Then I want the members of the committee that I'll talk about, and in particular John and Bing, to talk about their observation of the process and the outcome. And then Marina, who really knows the details, can go back to about a year ago and take us through where we are and where we're going. So by the end of, this should not take 2 hours. I mean, I was thinking originally this might be an hour, and how long it takes really depends somewhat on you. So let me get back to at least 20,000 feet. When I came into this job a little over a year ago, there was an idea floating around of $95 million expenditure on the Portland building. And the 95 numbers I forget, except it was a combination of leak repair, seismic, and moving employees out and back. And the moving employees out of the building and back in was a $28 million component of the 95. So at that time, I worried that I hadn't seen all the alternatives, and was that the best investment? And how do we, within the city, really compare investments? And it was difficult. So Bryant and Bob and Marina got back to lay out some alternatives, which she can talk about. And in the process, we thought it would be good to get some outside advice. So three of the members of our outside committee are here. And beyond that, we had Bob Ball, Roger Roper, and Ralph DiNola that gave us a sort of an environmental investment in buildings, historical side, and some other experience. So it was an excellent panel from our point of view, because we ended up with a conclusion we really didn't start with, and the ideas evolved through the discussions, and I think the committee members can talk a little about that. But in the process, we ended up saying, of all the alternatives, and it was all the way from, I don't think anyone seriously thought that we'd tear this building down, but if you're looking at all the alternatives, you can buy a fancy new building, tear one down, and lots of in between, including joint building with the county or other options that were looked at. But through our looking at numbers and then the discussion, it became pretty clear that the best investment we had was not just to fix the building, like repair the leaks and the seismic, but to actually invest in it and make it a 100-year building. And the discussions with Michael Graves would be, you could probably do that and improve it, because his comment in terms of the building was, he loves the building, but thinks the inside was a victim of Mayor Ivancy's cost cutting. and even some of the glass work and so on could have been done better, make it more comfortable within the building. So there's thoughts that we could, really could preserve the architectural integrity but make a major investment in the building that would make it a good place to work as well as one that wouldn't leak and that would be...
By the way, Fred, yeah. He has a great future in politics since he's already figured out the golden rule, which is to blame a former mayor.
That's good. Good. Well, I'll see if I can think of others to bring in. So our thought was, makes sense, let's work on this alternative. And your last decision point was in the fall bump where you approved some money that would work on the general costs, not the specific design costs, but general costs for making improvements. And those are supposed to be available in March, and Marina can address that. So the next thing that ultimately will be a decision is we have $3.7 million in our budget as realignment that would have gone to maintenance of the Portland building, but that could be used for more specific architectural drawings to actually get a project out of this. So it's a realignment, won't be a big thing in the budget. I mean, it's not new general fund, but it shows that there's some movement in that direction. When it does become interesting is if we, there could be a variety of financing options here, but if it were as simple as bonding and then paying it back, you could think in round numbers that this might be $10 million a year of lease payments that really come out of programs or ending balances or whatever. There's a financial burden to all of this. We don't know the exact amount of the improvements yet and won't till March, but nevertheless, there's that on the horizon. So basically, I think we're headed in a good direction. I'll mention one other item, but you need to obviously to agree that's the right direction, but there's not, as I say, a major decision to be made today. In our discussions, the additional item I wanted to add is if we had a vision for 2025 of where should we be with city workforce and buildings, there is the opportunity to do something with the county courthouse. I mean, they're building a new one. They'll be out in 2020. And one of the discussions we've had, and it's not really on the table yet, but just in terms of the vision, we could have something that might even be joint county-city, something with a courthouse that would have us with three historic buildings in a row for city employees that need to be in a centralized location. So that doesn't have to be on the table, but I just wanted to put it out there. Once we finish this project, it could be there's something else that would be possible that would help bring people in from a variety of outlying locations. So having said that, that's my 20,000-foot intro. I think it'd be good to hear a little bit from John and Bing about our committee process and whatever ahas they had out of it, because I think there were some.
John, you want to go first?
Okay. Well, the whole process was one of the best that I've ever been part of, and I was part of the renovation of this building. I was part of taking a look at the renovation of the county courthouse. But this process started with Marina surfeiting us with written material, and the staff work was complete. It was this much reading before we ever met. But each member of the committee, I think, made a unique contribution. In my case, office buildings is what I've done. And I developed the building across the street. I redeveloped the Tudor Market building. And what I think you have to recognize is that office buildings are like blank slates. When you strip them down to their basics, they're just a floor and a ceiling. And they're meant to be changed. They're built to be changed easily. And actually, in 40 years in my career, I've never had a prospective tenant, come into a space and say, "I like it. Don't change it. You know, move a wall." Well, moving a wall is what buildings are meant to do. But I think the most critical issue that I had was the concept of emptying the building to move out. And I can understand why people felt that was necessary, but it's not, in my opinion. The Tudor Market building was an asbestos building. And when I bought it, it was one-third vacant, which was ideal. So everybody in that building moved. A couple of people moved twice. But everybody functioned uninterrupted during that whole 20-month process. The work was done at night. And I think people in the building were unaware in their daily lives that kind of work was going on. And it was a lot more extensive than what you're contemplating here. I mean, we created two new steel shafts, but it was all done at night. And, you know, and another example of that more recently, we put in Northwestern Mutual, a full floor tenant, basically gutted the floor. Well, it was the floor right above Regent Blue Cross headquarters. They weren't disturbed, as you might imagine, by the work that went on. So, I don't think you have to move people out. You have to vacate some percentage of the building, I think, so that there's a swing space, so that you do a Rubik's Cube kind of an analysis of it. But the work that's required, even for a 100-year building, I don't think is that extensive, much less extensive than what we had to do. And one of the advantages of staying in the building is that when you move people out, if you have a bureau that needs 30,000 feet, you're not going to find 30,000 feet. You're going to find 3 tens, so that everybody gets spread out for quite a period of time. By retaining people, the majority of the people in the building, you preserve that proximity. But secondly, the norms of what's considered cutting-edge interior design have changed pretty dramatically in the last 5 years, and I think you have the ability to take advantage of that. There are some buildings in town that have completely eliminated their suspended ceilings, for example. More and more people are going to open office use, and to the extent you do that, it makes the renovation of the building even simpler. So,
and I guess in amplification of the process, we were pretty tough on Fred and his folks. We questioned, we demanded that we look at things that were, in our minds, really important for the city. So the one that's probably closest to my heart is the original budget really was a minimal fix-up kind of budget. We're going to fix the obvious problems. And my position was, look, I was around when this project was initiated and when there was a competition and when this particular design was selected. And all of the other people who participated all remarked that the original budget was inadequate. And so what we got was a building that met the budget, and now you're paying the price. So it's clear to me that cities need to think long-term, and this budget ought to be focused on turning this into a wonderful place to work. I'm sure we're all painfully aware it's not the favorite place for city employees today, and a place that you have made an investment that makes it energy efficient and makes it a 100-year building. So that was, the first revelation that we brought up. And probably the second one that I want to address is there's a notion that, why should we bother with this building? It's so deficient in light and so miserable in terms of its tenant amenities that it's a waste of money. And I think I want to amplify and build on what John said is, first of all, we did meet with Michael Graves, and I think we came to the conclusion that the dark glass can be eliminated and replaced with clear glass. Glass technology today is much different. You're going to have to replace the windows anyway. They're a mess. And then there's a large amount of what in the industry is called spandrel glass in the building. There are stripes, vertical stripes. A lot of it is opaque because it's spandrel glass. It's not vision glass. And I think you could look at the notion of, in fact, eliminating all the spandrel glass and the result would be much more daylight into the building. And probably, as John has mentioned, right now you have an 8-foot ceiling height, and all the offices clustered around the perimeter, and so a large amount of the building gets no daylight at all. And in fact, that isn't what anybody does today with space planning. So if you just imagine that you had adequate light and you put private offices at the core as opposed to the perimeter, and you eliminated the tile and suddenly you have a 13-foot ceiling and lighting today that would meet today's standards, you would be indeed amazed at how much better that building would be. And so I think we argued a little bit with Fred, but I think we feel good about the process and felt that it was really interactive and would meet the best long-term needs of the city.
If I could elaborate on that a little bit, the spandrel glass occurs at the center of each of the four sides. So you're talking about introducing a lot more light on each side of each floor of the building. Secondly, we really were lucky that Randy Gregg managed to get Michael Graves here. And the guy, as you may have been to the art museum, he put himself through a grilling that was really courageous. And what he said, and by the way, Roger Roper, the head of the State Historic Preservation Office, was part of our committee. What Graves said, I believe, is have at it. I, the architect, am not wedded, and I'm frankly not terribly proud about the way the building meets the street. You can change that. You can change the opacity of the glass. So you have this National Historic Landmark where the architect of record is saying, from my perspective, feel free.
Adding maybe two comments and then seeing if we can coax Tom into saying anything, which may be to all of our detriment. But two things. One of them, well, Bing talked about being tough on us. That's what we wanted. We did cut off their refreshments, but I think what we wanted is someone who had some ideas beyond what we had, and we actually loved how it moved because it wasn't our original idea. It was the group that came up with this is a better option, and it wasn't in the first meeting. It took a couple of meetings and discussion and pushing and pulling, so it worked the way citizens' committees ought to work, I think. The other comment I'll make is not everyone agrees with John on making the improvements with people out in the building. And we don't know. I mean, he's done it, and so is more of an expert than I am. But there are some who would say, no, don't do it. We're going to see, and we're going to check, and the dollars are going to determine that. $28 million is a lot to move people out and back, so we'd like to avoid that. But also, whatever the construction costs are, if they're considerably higher because we have to work around people, we'll find that out. So we love the idea as one of the options. I don't know what the outcome will be.
Well, the Tudor Market Building was always, the asbestos abatement was done on empty floors. You weren't working around anybody else on the floor.
Tom, can we tempt you?
What Bing and John have put before you is right on point. There is a solution here. It will be a 100-year solution, and I think it will ultimately involve the three blocks. Collectively, we won't get there overnight, but there is not a huge wellstone of surprise out ahead of us. It's just good, practical, hard work.
I did. The options, some of which, I mean, I don't think it's worthwhile having a long discussion of should we tear the building down or should we do that. So we're telling you where we're headed, but she can tell you a little bit about the process of getting there by going back to about a year ago.
Thank you. I am going to go back a little bit and provide the process maybe more from the project manager's perspective. So we'll kind of bring the elevation down a little bit. As Fred mentioned, we had been talking with all of you about a year ago. Many of you will probably remember that I came around and told you a little bit about what was going on with the building in terms of the failures and what we anticipated would need to be done to fix those failures. Part of those discussions made it clear that people were looking for more detailed information about what our alternative options would be to fixing the building. That was around the same time that Fred came on. He had the same concerns and the same questions. And we, at that point, we began developing fairly specific detailed information about costs and schedule and risks and constraints regarding six options. One of those options was the renovation project itself. They also had an option of selling the Portland building and buying an existing building somewhere else within the central downtown, central east side area. We looked at an option of selling the Portland building and building something new elsewhere, again within the same constraints. We looked at selling the Portland building and partnering with another entity such as the county or PSU or some other government partner to build a new building elsewhere. And we looked at demolishing the Portland building and building on this site. We also looked at selling the Portland building and moving everybody into outleases. We currently have some bureaus or portions of bureaus that are in outlease space. So we went ahead and looked at that as an option for everybody. Some of the things that came out of that fairly early on were that we had significant constraints due to the National Register listing on the building. And those constraints came at a number of different levels. So they meant things like local requirements. If we wanted to demolish the building, we would have to go through a Type 4 appeal process. That ultimately could be appealed to the Land Use Board of Appeals. So it would go outside of the city within decision-making jurisdiction. And it's a fairly lengthy process. State requirements, Roger Roper was helpful in pointing out to us that there's an ORS that says that essentially SHPO has to agree to any plans we make to dispose of the building or mothball it or do any sort of substantial alteration. So that was a fairly significant constraint as well. And then on the federal requirements, we had some folks that asked if it was possible for us to simply remove the National Register listing. It is possible to remove National Register listings. It's very, very difficult to do, and we would need the approval of SHPO to do that. They are the local delegate for the Secretary of the Interior. It was fairly clear from Mr. Roper that SHPO would not be providing that approval. So those affected sales, so the selling of the building, and they affected demolition. They provided some pretty major constraints. And in particular, when we started to look at trying to sell the building to someone else and allow them to do these things, not only did we have the constraint of would the state allow us to do that, could we knowingly sell it to somebody who is going to demolish it? It might be a difficult decision to make. But also, that would affect the buyer's ability to redevelop the property. So we looked at things like what was the cost to demolish the building. We got a very detailed cost estimate from a reputable national contractor who knew the building, knew the area, knew the constraints. And that cost estimate to demolish was significantly more than the land was worth. From a developer's standpoint, it starts to not make a whole lot of sense to buy it and demolish it, even if they were able to get through the demolition permit process. Could they buy the building and reskin it? That could be tough for a developer to do as well. Again, National Register listing means that all of that stuff is going to go through the Landmarks Commission, and this is a significant building. So these were some constraints that we presented to our advisory group. We looked at the real estate market for leasing. We looked at the real estate market for buying. We provided all the information to the advisory group. And and essentially let them have at it. They were wonderful discussions, very useful to us. It was so helpful to have their many points of view and their expertise to look at what we had provided. One of the key things that came out of that was the idea that we really should not be looking at just the exterior envelope and the seismic. If we were going to spend a substantial amount of money to bring the exterior of the building and the seismic, you know, up to a 50-year lifespan, then why were we not looking at the interior of the building as well? And while we certainly know from an operations standpoint what the mechanical systems are looking like, plumbing, we had some idea. We decided it would be in our best interest to go back to our design team and ask them to increase their assessment of the building to look at all the interior systems, interior finishes, and also things like our space layouts. As was pointed out, we could have better space layouts that allow for more daylight to come into the building, that really create a more efficient use of the space. So we asked them to go back and do an assessment of that. We had hoped to have that information by today, in fact. As the process goes, you know, we want to make sure that we are getting the best information that we can, and we have extended that out to ensure that we do get that. We don't have cost numbers at this point. Right now, we are anticipating that would be early March.
Can I ask a question on that?
Absolutely.
So we have a spreadsheet you've given us on costing out the various options, and the $95 million is the exterior and structural improvements. So mm-hmm. you're now looking at this other piece about what would it cost to improve the interior space and the workplace. Do you have kind of a ballpark for that? I mean, is there a rule of thumb, John, in terms of tenant improvements generally that you could say with some certainty it could fall from a low of this to a high of that?
Well, if you start from an empty floor, particularly if the ceiling is gone, making mechanical changes is cheap because it's all exposed. You're talking about ductwork changes that don't require dealing with all the things that interfere with it. And I'm always hesitant to talk about rules per square foot because depends, for example, in the building. We building owners have decided that the square foot's that big, for example. It's just hard. But it's certainly changing the mechanical system is something that really ought to be done. And if you're talking about emptying out a floor, it doesn't add appreciably to the cost. Again, the 200 Market building, to do asbestos abatement, everything on the floor was done, and we completely changed the entire mechanical system. That wasn't a big piece of the cost puzzle.
Can I add one thing on costs, and knowing less than the other people who are speaking, but just for the basis, the $28 million out and back is a key variable of the 95. So if we're to take that off the table for the moment, the base we're looking at for seismic and leak repair is 67. So the real issue is, what do we have to, if, assume we're going to do that as part of the process, what do we have to add to that, and what does the number become? But without knowing the answer on the out, back, and moves, it's hard to get to the right answer. And I ask Marina once a week on what's the best estimate, and I make them up periodically, but I have no idea what it is.
Helpful, by the way, as we step our way into this, if you would distinguish for us, or clarify for us, when you say leak, do you mean windows included? And therefore, when we look at that number for seismic and leak, whatever that number ultimately mm-hmm. is, when we look at that number for seismic and leak repairs, does that afford us the opportunity at little or no additional cost to make the changes in glass that you just discussed earlier, or, you know, at which point are we talking about enhancements to the basic project?
I think that the windows are included in the exterior. We would have to completely replace the windows and completely replace the surrounding frames of the windows in order to get the waterproofing to where it needs to be. I suspect that changing out the spandrel panels cost-wise would not be a significant difference from what we would be doing anywhere. Anyway, when we anticipated doing the exterior, we were going to have to remove all of the interior surface of the exterior wall, so all of the drywall that's there, and all of the insulation, and all of the steel studs behind it as well, because all of those materials have been so badly damaged by the water intrusion that we would be looking at a full-scale replacement of the inside of the wall anyway. Now, changing one section from being steel studs, insulation, and drywall to being a glass panel is not a significant difference. Those types of things, these are all the kinds of things that as we're looking at interior improvements, we would be going back and layering them back against the assumptions we had made for the existing project. So it's not like we would be taking on a new project. It's really that we already had a certain number of things that we already anticipated in the project, and we would be increasing the scope to that piece of it.
You said something in passing there that I don't think I understood. Maybe I just understood it now, and that is, are there places in the building where behind, inside of the spandrel glass, are studs and sheetrock?
Yes. So okay. It looks like glass from the outside.
Yeah.
And then it looks like a wall from the inside.
Didn't know that. Well, that's an obvious opportunity for improving the daylighting of the building, if that's how it was originally designed. Learn something every day. Thank you.
So where we are at the process today, and we have essentially we have our design team working on these interior cost conceptual designs to allow us to get kind of a conceptual cost estimate similar to the level of detail that we had previously. What we feel is a critical next step is to be able to develop the design enough that we know what we're pricing and to bring on a contractor that can help us understand the logistics of doing what we want to do and maybe steer us down the correct road as well in terms of the design. One of the nice things about a CMGC process is that when you bring on the design team and the contractor at the same time, there's a good feedback that goes back and forth between the two where contractors can provide some logistical, sort of practical constraints that will inform the design to a better solution. This is where we would like to go in order for us to give you really good construction costs. This is the step that we need to take, and what we are proposing to do is to realign our major maintenance funds to allow us to move forward with this. We would be moving into that phase in the next fiscal year. At the end of the fiscal year, we would have a guaranteed maximum price from the contractor. That's an actual construction price, so it's a solid price. And then we would be able to decide if this is where we want to go. There are some checkpoints along the way. This is not a blanket, you know, here's the money, go forth, and we won't see you for another year. We would be coming back to council for the contract approval for bringing the contractor on. So that would be for what we call pre-construction services. Similar to all pre-construction services contracts, we would be bringing that forward for approval. When we receive the guaranteed maximum price, we would schedule time to sit down with council and go through that guaranteed maximum price so that everybody could understand where the cost came from, what was involved in the design. And then, of course, prior to signing any construction contract, council would be approving that as well. Those are the minimum council sort of checkpoints, if you will, and we are definitely open to having more than that, but as a minimum, that is what would be in place.
So when would that first contract come to council?
The pre-construction services contract, we're estimating that would be around October of this year. So it takes time to do the RFP for the services and sort of go through the evaluation process.
But you don't have to come to us for permission to do that?
to do the RFP?
Yeah.
Would you like us to?
Well, it does seem to me that there is a policy decision to be made here, and that we're hearing the recommendation, and I actually support the recommendation, but okay. Part of the, yes, let's move along this road, is how are we going to pay for it? So are we going to get to that discussion shortly?
Up to you, because there are, Ken is here, we get into the financing, because there are no decisions that are close to being made on that, but maybe the orders of magnitude would be interesting for you. Maybe just prior to that, you should take us through, let's say this all works, when are we going to see a new improved building? I mean, take us through the time frame, and then do financing.
Okay, so the soonest that we would see a new building is April of 2018. That's, we provided you a schedule. It's a very aggressive schedule. I'll be quite upfront about that. I could walk you through the schedule that's there, but it's essentially what we've been talking about. We would be asking for your approval to realign our major maintenance funds to move forward with the design and the pre-construction services. That would be the contract, that first contract that you would be looking to approve.
So we would approve that realignment as part of this budget process?
Yes. Then, as you can see, the council approvals are kind of those blue diamonds. That pre-construction services contract is the one that's in October. We would move forward with the design and having the contractor on the team at that point. When we got to the guaranteed maximum price, May or June, of 2016, we would be coming back to review that information. And assuming that you thought it was a fabulous deal and you decided immediately that we were going forward, remembering that this is an aggressive schedule, we would look to procure the construction itself. We would look for council approval on the contract and then move forward with construction. We're estimating approximately 2 years. But again, that's going to depend quite a bit on the scope of the work that is to be done. So that is an aggressive schedule.
Commissioner Fritz, I thought that time frame would be useful because what the financing obviously relates to, when are we looking for the money at some stage in that. But I'd love to have Ken hold forth a bit on financing.
Thanks, Fred. And we've done some very early work on this. Obviously, we don't have a project budget yet. We don't know when the bonds would be sold. So there's a lot of assumptions that we've had to make. And so take it with the appropriate size grain of salt. But let's assume that we issued $100 million of bonds for the project. That, again, don't know what the project cost is, but we've run numbers recently, as recent as yesterday on this. And let's assume that the term of the bonds that we would be issuing would, we did three different options, 20-year debt, 25-year debt, or as long as 30. You know, typically, the city does not like to go to the 30-year term. It's a real estate transaction. You could make the argument that it would be appropriate for this particular project. But we would also need to look at our debt policies and see whether that would square with that. But for purposes of analysis, we've done that. The longer the term, the lower the borrowing annual debt service cost is. So a $100 million transaction in today's market, and you know, when you're in an almost global deflation environment, interest rates are very attractive. Whether they're going to stay that low remains to be seen. But right now, for $100 million borrowing at 20 years, we'd be paying debt service of about $6.8 million a year to amortize that loan over the 20 years. If we drop the term to 30 years, it's around the $5.5 million mark. So again, very attractive borrowing terms at this point in time. Now, that's also assuming that we would just drop in a level debt service structure, equal annual payments for each year of the amortization of the bonds. The things we haven't done is to look at how we might sculpt the debt to take advantage of opportunities in the city's long-term financial projections to place principal and amortization in a way that would help to minimize some of the earlier costs or have a ramp up into the debt service obligation so that we could build in to what that might mean in terms of impacts on city bureaus and the general fund, et cetera. So a lot more work could be done. We know that there will be longer-term obligations of the city that roll off. Some of them are a little further away for us to get to. For example, the pension obligation bonds will end. The amortization of that ends in about 15 years. Is there an opportunity to backfill when those obligations go away so that we can minimize some of those upfront costs? So I think what I would say is that borrowing rates are attractive. That's a tool we can certainly utilize. Don't have a firm budget yet. Don't know what it's going to translate in terms of an annual cost. But there are opportunities for us to see what we can do to make that impact smaller in the early years and to minimize what that might mean to bureaus and to the general fund overall. So that's kind of where we're at today. It gives you, I think, an order of a magnitude of where we're, what we're looking at.
Essentially asking for a $6 million allocation from the general fund ongoing.
That could be as much as that. The options that we're looking at now under the 20-year bond scenario, it actually is greater than that. If we're at 25 years, it's around that. That's a reasonable estimate of the market at $100 million borrowing for around 25 years, which is consistent with the terms that we typically borrow at.
So then if we're going to do that, which would mean cuts across the general fund bureaus, potentially an impact on rates since the Water Bureau is currently in the Portland building, so they would be... and BES also would be joining in. I think we need to have a wider discussion about the other capital needs within the city. That I have Parks employees who work on the 13th floor of the Portland building in leaky, moldy conditions. I have Parks employees who work elsewhere. We have the Sears building and the Westside Emergency Center that we don't have the money to make fit for habitation. So knowing that this proposal does impact everything else we do. I think it's a wider policy discussion as to, it's not just a discussion of should we realign your budget within OMF. It's a discussion of what are the citywide facilities needs. We're waiting on a city budget office is going to be working with OMF to have some kind of a plan for facilities citywide. I'm just not clear as to why we're moving forward expeditiously with this one and leaving everybody else behind.
Mm-hmm. Commissioner, if I may, and I'm a simple arithmetic guy as opposed to Ken, but if you take a $6 million debt payment on the number of square feet in that building, you get to the equivalent of about two-thirds of a market rent. So if you took those 300,000 square feet of tenants out into the private market, you'd be paying half again the annual rent that you'd be paying in your bond payments.
I could just pose a question to Ken related to this topic. Conceptually, what are the different models for allocating the cost? So if you were giving us like a 101 on how we might allocate the debt service costs, What are the menu of options that council has? The most straightforward, the most exotic. What's the range that you come to us and discuss?
Okay, I haven't without the benefit of without thinking a lot about that. I mean, clearly we have a methodology now where we take the building related costs and we spread them to the tenants in the building on a per square foot basis or something like that. So much like what John just mentioned, we would take those costs and look at spreading them to all the tenants of the building based on their usage of the building. So that's probably a pretty straightforward way, pretty understandable and consistent with the practices that we typically follow. You could look at different bureaus wanting to buy their own floor space, and that's a model that has been used before as well, where the enterprise bureaus, maybe from the point of view of the way it works for them on their balance sheet, it makes sense for them to buy the space. They don't get an ongoing allocation, and they deal with it separately in their own financials. And so that reduces the remaining cost, then that gets distributed to the other tenant bureaus. But generally, it's going to be based on some sort of measurement of usage, per square foot cost, like you would typically see if we were renting space from a private office building in the downtown Portland area, is the methodology that we've typically used for real estate transactions for our bureaus. And I would expect that we would have some variation of that going forward. Clearly, the general fund could decide it wanted to make some ongoing contribution that would write down the cost to those bureaus such that the resulting cost to tenant bureaus would be lower. But we, there's all kinds of flavors that we can play in between with that.
And just with respect to the buy option, just concept,
you know, when the big pipe was being worked on, I believe this occurred during Dan's watch, the city had the option of buying or leasing some of the dirt they needed to do the big pipe. So industrial property on the waterfront, Swan Island, other places. And I wasn't here at the time, but I understand it was a pretty controversial decision, and it was the Bureau and leadership decision at that time to buy. So we bought some properties, now than lease properties. Well, lo and behold, now that we're disposing of properties, it looks like a genius made that decision because of the scarcity of industrial land and the appreciation of the dirt. So we thank the people that made that decision. But that's a unique situation where the Bureau knew at some point they would dispose. They would no longer need the land. So if you lease, the lease term ends. If you sell, then you hope that you make a profit. Mm-hmm. What's the advantage to a Bureau of owning the property other than it shows up on your balance sheet as an asset? I mean, technically, could you sell it at some point, or is it more an accounting issue?
I think, Commissioner, it's not likely that it's going to be sold per se, because even if they had a condominium interest in the Portland building, you can't sell that very easily. And so it would be encumbered in a way that, from that point of view, is really a different kind of analogy. But my understanding, having worked with different of the enterprise funds over the years, is that a lease payment that comes to them in the form of an operating expense has a different impact on what they measure in terms of debt service coverage, which is a very important ratio that they present to bondholders, than a debt service payment that hits their financials in a different way in terms of coverage earned on that and the impact ultimately on rates and charges. So there are some differences that are meaningful to certain of the enterprise funds based on the financial model that they use that supports their long-term capital program that rolls through to rates and charges and also has some beneficial impact on the balance sheet as well.
To Commissioner Fritz's point, would it be, I assume actually this is probably not possible because we haven't analyzed all of our failing buildings to find out how much it would cost to fix them, but I was just as a sort of a prayer, would it be possible to look at all of our buildings with, you know, that are in bad condition and see where we get our biggest bang for the buck in terms of sort of dollars spent per employee in the building? So, I mean, you could argue that if it's possible to make 11 other buildings with the same number of employees habitable with less money, then Commissioner Fritz could argue that's what we should do.
Glad you asked that. As a matter of fact, we're actually working on right now a building condition assessment for all of the OMF-owned buildings, but we've offered that out to the other bureaus also. So we're looking to, one, come up with the same language to give an assessment for all city-owned buildings, and then number two, we're looking at the space utilization and are we best serving the public in the buildings we are and where does that work out. So we're, again, when we talk about the number of times we move people, we're looking at this as an opportunity to go broader than the Portland building, look at all the city buildings that, you know, kind of the support service, and then say, where does this work into the big plan, and where should people be, and where should the city invest its money into the infrastructure?
How many people work in the Portland building? Is it?
The number varies by the day, depending on hiring and loss and so on and so forth. We've plugged our number as somewhere around 1,300. That does include county as well. And remember that we also have retail spaces. So we have people in the retail spaces that we don't really have any way to count.
Two questions. I mean, one, what is the consequence of doing nothing? And two, how do you, a guaranteed maximum price sounds very appealing, but I'm confident there's probably all sorts of conditions around what a guaranteed maximum price includes. So the sensitivity analysis, what are we looking at in terms of plus and minus $67 million? I don't think you know that yet, but I think that's an important question for us to deal with, because it would strike me that there's probably, as you even mentioned in your unknown conditions, and that's always
the bane of any guaranteed maximum price or of even course. A low bid price. So,
of course.
So I guess, yeah, those are things I'll be wondering about.
I think it might be worth discussing the do-nothing option a little bit. I don't have the answer, but the do-nothing, when you have the leaks and the seismic question, becomes an interesting proposition. And one of the elements that we're looking at from a different angle is disaster recovery of data in our computer system here, and it relates, the doing nothing leaves us exposed. We have to worry about somehow disaster recovery, but it's more complicated than just say, can we leave it alone? I don't know physically the impact of the risk related to seismic, and Marina knows more about leaks than I do, but take us through a do nothing, what your view.
I think Fred is accurate in saying that there's essentially two components to it. There's the water infiltration piece of it, and then there's the seismic piece. There's been a lot of discussion about the seismic, and when you think about it, that is the catastrophic failure, but it's hard to pin down because we can only say it in terms of percentages. What's the percentage chance that it'll occur? The percentages, I think, can vary to some extent depending on who's providing them. I think the consequences are fairly catastrophic. So that's the balance you need to look at when you're talking about the seismic. We know from the structural engineers that they anticipate even in a fairly mild earthquake, we could have some areas of the building that would not be safe for people to return to. That's significant because if they're not safe for people to return to, then people cannot get all of their materials out of there. They can't get their records. They can't get to their computers. It makes recovery very, very difficult for the city as a whole. So that's kind of the catastrophic failure side of things. Take it as you will. The water infiltration for us is a fairly pressing concern. We have, anytime it rains, we have reports of water dripping. Pretty much the entire 14th floor has water on windowsills on every elevation. And we already know that the water has infiltrated in some areas well into the concrete floor slabs. We did a project on the fourth floor where we removed carpet and discovered that the concrete slab was wet all the way in from the exterior wall to 30 feet into the center of the building. When you have that significant amount of wetting of the concrete structure, then you should anticipate that there is damage occurring to the structure of the building. One of the reasons we did an assessment of the structure was because of that concern. Anytime that you have water inside the concrete, it has the ability to get to the rebar. If there are any cracks in the concrete where there's air, that rebar will rust. When it rusts, it expands, it cracks the concrete more. This has an impact on the structure. So aside from the environmental conditions of having water in the building, of insulation that is no longer useful because it's been wet so often, peeling wallpaper, things that make for a very difficult working environment, we also have our ongoing concerns about what this is doing to the underlying structure of the building and maintaining the asset that we have.
Marina, I think you just...
Just in response to that, there's a four-letter word that strikes fear in the hearts of anybody in my business. It's mold. And there's just the threat of employees, tenants, whatever, suing because of the damaging effects of mold. So we've had leaks, and particularly in our historic buildings, we take them very seriously, and they are immediately remediated. So that's a big deal. And when you're talking about, and we've seen it, and the committee saw it, drywall on the inside of the perimeter, that drywall, particularly the paper face of it, stays wet forever, and it's just it's a perfect place for mold. You don't want to see that.
Mayor, this is really an excellent discussion, and I appreciate you and Fred holding this discussion. And I think we're getting to the point where we probably have all the information we need in this phase. Can I just... Okay, I'm sorry. This commissioner is getting close. Right? We are five. Can I just put a couple of questions on the record? And I don't need answers today. I'm reminded, Charlie, that when Fred first briefed me on this and gave me his thoughts, I was of two minds. My first reaction was to try to get on your calendar and talk about initiating disciplinary proceedings. And then as I thought about it, I was grateful that we were calling the question. And that's what we're doing here. We're calling the question. We have to sort of figure out next steps. But I think it's important to call the question. And I have a lot more confidence about the path forward, knowing that it's been vetted with experts in the field. So I appreciate that. Obviously, how we pay for it is something I'm very interested in, particularly because David Schaff and others, we're bound to a five-year forecast, and there's a lot of complex moving pieces. So that's the piece I'd like to know more about sooner rather than later, and then consider the impact. I'm the arts commissioner, so I'm just curious what happens to Portlandia during this transition. I don't know whether you thought about that, but does Portlandia need to be relocated, or can she stay on her precarious perch while you're doing structural work? I don't know the answer. What's the fair market value of the building after we make these changes? Because it's an asset in our inventory. So, you know, this is, at some point, we do all this work, and then we have an asset that's worth more, and it shows up on our balance sheet as worth more. So just curious how that enhances our overall financial picture. The other thing I wanted to make a pitch for is that I had the good fortune of working with Marina on the PHB, the Housing Bureau relocation to a very distinguished building. And I learned that we have great capacity in-house to do the tenant improvement work. In fact, I think you did all that planning, so we didn't ship it out. You did the plan for the floor space. And the thing that I really appreciated was you engaged the employees about what kind of workspace they wanted. So they got to customize it. And so, are we thinking of doing this in-house? And B, will we have the chance to engage employees at the same level to make sure that the workplace we create for folks, assuming we can afford it, is the workplace that they want? Because I think what we've heard, obviously, is for a long time, people haven't liked working in the building. And the ideas that John has thrown out about lifting the ceiling, getting more light, rearranging the space, I mean, that has a huge impact on morale and productivity. And so I hope that there's the similar commitment to fully engaging all the employees in that visioning process. So thank you.
Thank you.
Issues you need to hear more about on the record.
Well, first, thank you very much to the committee for serving. And if we do move forward with this project, I hope that there will be an ongoing oversight committee. I'd like to add women and people with disabilities to the committee so that we make sure that we're covering all the bases. It seems to me there are three main questions here. Are we going to do this? Are we going to do it now? And are we going to do just this, or are we going to do more? And I think that those questions really need to be active decisions made with public input. And with all due respect, Mayor, the budget process, people are advocating for their own most urgent need. They have 3 minutes. And I would recommend that we hold a separate public hearing on this question. Because if we go down this path, we're talking potentially several million dollars of impact to the general fund, and that means cuts in the services. Having done so many cut budgets, I'd like to make that decision with the public to agree that this is a priority, whether this is the only priority, and figure out, and so that people know we're looking at cuts starting in X year and how that might work. So that's my first recommendation, is that we make this as a separate active decision rather than doing it in the CMGC contract and the RFP and all these other things that are moving us down a road which the community of Portland has not yet said that they agree with. I appreciate this presentation and the layout of the six different options. I did come to the same conclusion that this is the way to go. I'd like the public to know what we now know. You know, usually we have a work session and then we have a public hearing, and so I would suggest we do that. I do wonder, Michael Graves' comments, are those in writing? Is there a video?
I don't know whether there's a video or not. I'm sure there must be. It was in the venue was the Portland Art Museum, wasn't it? And it was packed. I mean, it was a very big deal. And he got harassed, really, by the public.
But are his comments in writing?
There are some comments that were done as part of interviews with various media. So we have a number of articles. We also have him on a retainer through our design consultant, and we have for the last 2 years or so. So the intent is that he would be brought in. We had budgeted for him to assist with the design process to ensure that we were able to hear his voice as we were kind of working our way through the historic issues.
So this project would be subject, presumably, to both design review and historic landmarks review?
Yes.
So I'm wondering, have you had an advisory meeting with either of those commissions to float this concept with them?
We had an advisory meeting with the Landmarks Commission in, I want to say it was October of 2012, when we had first completed the exterior assessment. We were still working on the seismic assessment. We did talk them through the issues that we were finding and what we foresaw as being problematic in terms of preservation and typical preservation process, which
I would recommend that you have now. If we decide to move forward with this project, I would suggest a more public advisory meeting with both of those commissions, because although from a practical standpoint, the lights, the changing from the opacity and the color of the glass sounds really helpful to making the building more livable. If the Historic Landmarks Commission is going to say no, actually part of the designation is that it's a dank and dismal place, we would potentially need to rethink, do we still want employees working in a dank and dismal place? So I want to make sure that we get that design advice early so that we're not going down a path that then the commissions, after you've done all your engineering and design work, architectural work, then if either commission says no, we're in a bind.
Just add one other thing to my list, and this is directed to you, Fred, and your team, and to Steve. When we had that electrical problem on the street that shut down our systems in City Hall and put strains on our emergency systems, this question came up of, do we have enough generator capacity and everything else? So I'm assuming that in any renovation, we're building in whatever investment we need to make sure we have the generator capacity to run that building and the little historic building next door that might be impacted by another electrical interruption. And paid your electrical bill?
I have one very serious question, one 95% frivolous question, and one thought I wanted to put on the table. The very serious question is, Marina, I think you said in a moderate earthquake, the building might be unsafe for people to return. In a really big earthquake, might people in the building actually die? Or people outside the building hit by falling debris?
I can't guarantee. So let's talk about the falling debris one, because that one's a little bit easier. We have we do know that the tiles at the top of the building, the lath that supports them, is rusted. It's significantly rusted. We already know that. We haven't lost any tiles off of there yet. I would say that's the next step. Now, in terms of would people die in a severe earthquake, I can't answer that question. Our structural engineers are completely unwilling to answer that question. They come back and say, how do you define severe? So what they have said is we could see localized areas of gravity loss. And they felt that not looking at internal elements such as light, such as, you know, drop ceilings, refrigerators, the types of things that can create quite a bit of damage in an earthquake because they're typically not as well attached. Not looking at those elements, simply looking at the structure itself, they felt most people would be able to get out of the building. But they did feel that nobody would be going back in. They anticipated people would be able to leave. They didn't talk about injuries, they didn't talk about any of that. And again, remember, there are those other elements. There are, you know, the microwaves and the pipes that run overhead. And are all of those braced to seismic? Probably not. Where we've done renovations, absolutely. Where there are no renovations, no, probably not.
Thank you very much. The 95% frivolous question is, given the artistic significance of the building, couldn't we just rededicate the arts tax to the Portland building? Or at least have part of it to, like, relocate Portlandia? And the thought that I wanted to put on the table is, Commissioner Fritz is right, $6.5 million out of the general fund means severe cuts to bureau budgets. Given we're talking about a long-term project, one potential source of general fund revenue is allowing urban renewal areas to expire. And I think one thing that we might want to consider is, at what point do various urban renewal areas expire? How much general fund do we get? And how dangerous would it be to wait to start spending money until we have that additional source of revenue?
Team can do forecasting based on different scenarios, right? So we'll call on them to do that. While we're being frivolous, I won't put this on the record, but I did. I'll tell you the rest of the story off the privately sometime. But I did, when I was Parks Commissioner, get an offer from a prominent local business person to move the Portlandia statue off the building, and I politely declined on a couple of grounds. One of which is that no one really was ever intended to see her from the rear view.
Am I in charge?
Suggestions either from us or from you, Fred?
Whatever happened to certificates of participation? They seemed like a pretty low barrier way to do things. I'm not sure. Yeah. It's a dead instrument, and it used to be used a lot when I started my public service, but I don't hear it much anymore.
And the answer to that is that we don't need to use that particular form of finance any longer. The COP-type transaction was used in Oregon in the late 80s. We did the Justice Center improvements with that, and I think the Portland building might have been a COP transaction initially, but state law over the years has changed and given us clearer authority to issue what we call limited tax revenue bonds, which include a pledge of general fund revenues. And so the machinations that we used to go through to create something that looked like debt, walked like debt, but that wasn't debt, we no longer have to do, and so we have a clear ability to pledge the general fund, which is a more direct credit and a better credit, and takes care of and eliminates really the need to issue that form of finance. So in Oregon, there haven't been COP issues probably for over 20 years. Other states like California do them for debt restriction related reasons, but we no longer have those kinds of impediments, and so no longer rely on that, and haven't for quite a while.
Two questions, and one's to Fred and your team. What do you need from the five of us in the next step? And then the reverse, some of which you've already articulated. What do we need from you and your team and your advisors in order to approach the next gate in this slalom?
Well, I was thinking of the next two moving pieces. One is we should have the numbers back so we have a response to how much will all this cost sometime in March. I'm looking for the right nod. So that makes it a better discussion, because it's $67 million plus something. And is this something huge or a little bit? I don't know. So we'll have that in March. The next decision point is the realignment package. I mean, to really say, okay, if we're moving ahead, what do we do with it? So Andrew now sits with that, if I'm not mistaken, in terms of budget submittals. So you're going to see that through the normal process. So those are the two elements that add to our understanding. We essentially did what I was hoping would happen today, is for you to understand where it is and be able to ask questions and understand the variables and understand what we don't know. So we're still developing the information. And as I say, in March, we'll know more.
Other requests? So based on that, I would say we ought to reconvene in probably this kind of format sometime before we complete the budget process, but after March. Get the more detailed cost and options for payment information as well as maybe information about the context of other facilities that you've raised. And then before we complete the budget process, obviously we have a yes or no decision about do we want to authorize this realignment for purposes of further architectural and document preparation or not. But we have until May to decide that.
And I think the earthquake isn't predicted till April, so you should have more information.
And Mayor, you and I can talk offline about the mechanics of how do we get this, the public to be aware of this. We're talking about spending $100 million of the public's money, and there's no press here. So I would suggest that a work session probably doesn't get the kind of attention that a public hearing where people can weigh in. I agree with Fred that having that number as to what are we talking about, having some more suggestions from all sides as far as what's in. I mean, it's, are we going to do this? Are we going to do it now? Are we going to do more than this? And I think those are the questions that would be helpful for us to discuss. Because if we're going to bite the bullet and cut $6 million a year, maybe we should look at cutting 8 or 10 or 21 like we did before and really look at, we've got a lot of facilities. I mean, you're talking about mold and water on windowsills. I think I have park staff working where we have mushrooms growing. It's, I mean, we could give you a tour of some of our other dilapidated and non-compliant. You know, we've got the ADA transition plan that we're required to do that we don't have funding for, and identify places where people with disabilities, they just can't go because there's no bathroom, there's no elevator. So I'm actually more in favor, if we're going to do this, let's look at what are the most crucial facilities that we need to invest this taxpayers' money in and figure out how to do it.